The Bob Siegel Show on KCBQ is sponsored by Bob Siegel.
The Bob Siegel Show is brought to you in part by Primetime Advertising Corporation and the law offices of Matthew Simone.
Recurring themes on The Bob Siegel Show can also be found in this Washington Times Communities column, Forbidden Siegel Talk.
It's time now for The Bob Siegel Show, a religious open forum where all questions are welcome. And now, here's your host, Christian apologist, Bob Siegel.
And this is Bob Siegel. So, you'd like to believe in God, but you wonder where God is when our entire country is falling apart. Well, my friend, God works in many different ways, but throughout history, we notice that he has mostly used people. Occasionally, the right man comes along at the right time. A brave man comes forth, one who speaks his mind and takes what comes. We have such a man with us today as a guest. He's calling us from British Columbia. The name will be familiar to so many of you, Michael Moriarty. Michael Moriarty is no stranger to stage, screen, and television. He's a winner of numerous prestigious awards, some of the more familiar being the Tony, several Emmys, and the Golden Globe. I am honored to have him as a guest for two reasons, both of which are equally important to me personally. First, I am a longtime fan of Michael Moriarty. I have admired his acting for years. So many actors today overact. Michael Moriarty knows how to do a character by underplaying. Now, the term underplay may be unfamiliar to those without drama backgrounds. Believe me, it's a compliment. It refers to one who is not so over the top or larger than life that we find the ensuing performance unbelievable. With subtlety and a softer disposition, Mr. Moriarty is never caught acting for even a second. He becomes the character he plays. The other reason I'm honored to have Michael Moriarty as a guest is that we seem to be kindred spirits politically. Not that we would agree on everything. Nobody would ever agree on everything, but certainly on the important matters, we both share grave concerns for the direction our country is going and the agenda of America's present administration. These days, it takes courage for a Hollywood actor to go against the grain and speak against liberalism. Only a handful of others, such as John Voight, have taken similar stands. Meanwhile, Mr. Moriarty also gives it to the conservatives when he deems it necessary. In addition to his impressive acting accolades, Michael Moriarty writes a provocative column for Washington Times Communities, with whom I am also affiliated. We met in that context. Mr. Moriarty is far more than an actor and columnist. He is also a jazz pianist, singer, and classical composer. He has recorded 3 jazz albums and has performed live in both New York and Vancouver with a jazz trio and quintet. Television fans probably remember him best in Law & Order from 1990 to 1994, where he starred as the district attorney Ben Stone. There was some controversy about his departure from that series, which we will let him explain in a few minutes in his own words. Michael Moriarty won the Emmy Award in 1973 for a television adaptation of The Glass Menagerie. He also won a Tony in 1974 for his work in Find Your Way Home. He won both the Golden Globe and the Emmy for his role in the miniseries Holocaust. In 1996, he was the Chicago Film Festival's award winner for Outstanding Actor in Broken Silence. In 2001, he won another Emmy for Outstanding Actor in the miniseries James Dean. Today, we will begin with Mr. Moriarty's artistic career and then get into the heavier discussion of American society later. Michael Moriarty, welcome to our program.
Oh, my God, what an introduction.
Well, I am so honored to have you here.
Not only do you sell God like a car salesman, which is progressive, but despite your nerves, and we're both very nervous, it was the best introduction of me and my career that I've had in 72 years.
Well, I am honored to hear that. And unlike a used car salesman, what I said about you is true. It is the truth. Absolutely. Well, listen, let's get right into this because we have limited time, and I know I'm going to want to have you on again, but let's get as much as we can today. I'm going to just start with, I don't think as many people know about your jazz career, so that's of interest to me. After one of your 1990 concerts, New York Times reviewer Stephen Holden called you a jazz pianist of considerable skill, an oddball singer with more than one vocal personality, and a writer of eccentric, jivey jazz songs. Do you agree with that assessment?
Yeah, I'd go beyond that, but I'm glad it's your first question, because I get to plug. This is a plug, ladies and gentlemen. Please tune in on your computer to 77, not Sunset Strip, 77 Gelsomina, G-E-L, write this down, 77 G-E-L-S-O-M-I-N-A, to hear my music, both my jazz and the liner notes by Mel Torme, and my etudes for classical ensemble as well. This is a short answer, but music will have another talk about music a little later at greater length.
Okay,
so
absolutely.
There's my first answer. It's your turn to ask a question.
You betcha. Well, let's get back into your acting career next. Although your career far precedes the television version of Glass Menagerie and the miniseries Holocaust, most Americans, being more familiar with television than film and theater, probably were introduced to you at that time. But what would you consider your first significant acting break?
And this I've written, and because it deserves it. Find Your Way Home, a Broadway play by John Hopkins.
How long ago did you do that?
Directed by a profoundly underappreciated artist, the husband of Jane Alexander, Ed Sheeran. More actors have won Tony Awards under his direction than any other director I can think of. James Earl Jones, Jane Alexander, and myself are just three that I know of. In Find Your Way Home, I played a screamingly gay but divinely honest homosexual. The role won me a Tony Award and rather remarkable set of victories over an impressive quartet of English-speaking theater legends, Jason Robards Jr., Nicole Williamson, Zora Steele, and George C. Scott.
Okay, so that was the one you won your Tony Award for, Find Your Way Home. So that, okay. Now, what, Mr. Moriarty, what made you decide to go into acting?
Acting was one of the few art forms that my father knew nothing about. This is a basic father-son problem.
So it was a way to get out of his shadow?
Hello?
Was it a way to get out of your father's shadow then?
Well, out from under a lot of my father's nonsense. At any rate, music would have been my first love, but my father knew a great deal about music. He had the best record collection of both classical and jazz in Detroit, and I was raised on the greatest music in the world from infancy. And so, given that lust for music and love of it, when I didn't move as fast on my piano lessons as my father thought I should, he took the piano lessons away. So, what do? I took acting as an alternative. It was the fifth choice I might have made for a career. So, I ended up an actor because, indeed, my father wouldn't help me pursue music.
Well, I guess in a strange way, we're indebted to your father, because I'm very glad you made the choice of acting. What role was your personal favorite? Was it Find Your Way Home, or was there another role that you would consider your personal favorite?
The favorite's Law and Order.
Oh, okay. Well, because you got a chance to develop that for several years. What role did you consider perhaps the most important in terms of the message conveyed? maybe it wasn't your personal favorite, but she's considered it a very important role.
Eric Dorff in The Holocaust.
Okay, well, that leads me to my next question. I saw Holocaust when it came out. Devastating, but being of Jewish descent myself, I've researched the Holocaust. This, although it had fictitious characters on it, it was dead on accurate. And in Holocaust, you played a very scary character. Scary because in the beginning, he seemed to be a very typical and somewhat decent individual. Eric Dorff, a German husband and father who had a Jewish doctor and was very appreciative of the doctor's service. But in time, Dorff got involved with the SS. We slowly witness his transformation as he rationalizes Nazi involvement one piece at a time. What was it like playing a character such as Dorff?
Well, Bob, I got a long answer for this. Are you going to give me time to answer this at length?
You bet.
The most difficult role I've ever encountered and the most painful role to remember, with one exception and one exception only, the great and wonderfully gracious English actor Ian Holm, who befriended me after we completed our first scene together. Aside from the great Ian Holm, the British cast members were generally resentful and contemptuous of me. Of all the cultures on this earth, none can shower contempt more generously or eloquently than the Brits. That may come from my Irish descent, a certain level of wariness. At any rate, I'm not entirely sure such a gift has endeared the Brits to an increasingly varied fraternity of historians. At any rate, moving right along, I think the Irishness and literary legend or infamy within my last name, Moriarty, had something to do with it. Now, about Holocaust, since the Nazis were performed all by Brits, with myself as the one American exception, why shouldn't the plum role be given to a Brit as well? Kind of like, why can't the Americans teach their children how to speak? It escaped the Brits' acting community and their attention that the producers of Holocaust wanted to teach a lesson to Americans, and Americans particularly, about careerism, a commitment to anything for the sake of one's endlessly personal advancement and increasingly voracious ambitions. Are you listening, Susan Rice of the Obama administration?
No kidding. Good example.
Such careerism can get you personally, your personal eternity, into profoundly deep trouble. And if biblical rumors are at all confirmed, into the profoundly deepest hell imaginable. A recognizably American actor in the role of Eric Dorff gave the producers what they wanted, an American-looking and sounding Nazi careerist in the Third Reich. Why? John Dean of the Nixon administration and the Watergate scandal. That had been the inspiration for the creation of the character Eric Dorff in The Holocaust.
Interesting.
Isn't it? Now, instead of John Dean of the Nixon administration, we have Susan Rice of the Obama administration.
We sure do. Well, you know, whatever their reason, whatever their agenda for giving you that award, on the sheer basis of your acting, you absolutely deserved it. Would you say that you're into what's commonly called method acting, famous? Oh, good.
No, but ironically, I agree.
I agree with that, but I was curious.
I was trained by the Brits at the London Academy of Music and Dramatic Arts.
So you would agree with Laurence Olivier that acting is just acting?
No, you're not becoming the character. Don't agree with that either.
Oh, okay. Where would you come down then?
Ultimately, James Woods' understanding. You either have the gift or you don't. And if you don't try it. You got to have as a gift that's beyond understanding. It cannot be analyzed, and nor should it be. If you have it, flaunt it and be an actor. And despite my years of teaching acting, which I was pretty good at, the real gift is you're either born with it or you're not.
Well, you were certainly born with it. And yes, it is interesting, the difference between a gift and a skill. But either way, how did it affect you personally in Holocaust to play such a cold-hearted villain as Eric Dorth, whose views of life are obviously so different from your own? Did that have any kind of emotional effect on you?
Well, I'm trying to find myself in this list of questions. Here I am. Well, I found one scene almost impossible to play. And I stopped in the middle of it a number of times. That earned me the dubious distinction of being the least respected actor in the entire Holocaust company. I found it almost impossible to say the things that Dorf had to say in the presence of a piano that my character, Eric Dorf, had virtually stolen from the Holocaust central figures, the Weiss family. And the tears I shed later in the film, when my character's facing inevitable capture by the Americans, those tears were hardly those of a crocodile. They were my tears. Why? This is fascinating. The director showed me previously unseen photos of the Holocaust, one of which was a mother and her child, both about to be executed.
Wow. Wow.
The SS officer, most undoubtedly a careerist, was ordered to kill both of them, the mother and the child, with the same bullet.
No kidding.
So this mother was forced to hold her child up to her face while the Gestapo pulled the trigger, killing both of them with the same bullet.
That is so... creepy and horrible.
If that is not the still dreamed of and Hitlerized version of a New World Order efficiency, I don't know what is. Right after showing me photos like that, the director shot the scene and I could barely remember my lines, let alone say them. Those photos had destroyed my actor's defense mechanisms against the horrors and unspeakable realities of the Holocaust, and whether the tears were appropriate or not, I still haven't made up my mind. I think possibly Eric Dorf was too cold and too protected by a veneer to even cry about the reality of the horrors within them. And as an example, here's Brando saying, "The horror of it all. The horror of it all," he says it in Apocalypse Now. Compared to the Holocaust of World War II and its summary executions of 6 million Jews and God knows how many other so-called inferior races, compared to that, the war in Vietnam was a prolonged, but relatively speaking, in terms of the horror of it all, compared to World War II and the killing machines of the Holocaust. I mean, America's Hollywood and its far-left Marxist hatred of America, the horror of the Holocaust will not, God willing, ever, ever be equaled again.
Hopefully not. And it came at a time in history where people were teaching that human beings were morally evolving. And yet, what an indictment on the things man is capable of doing.
Bob, if you combine mass killings by the orders of Joseph Stalin and the mass starvation instigated by Mao Zedong, who stole the rice of China from the mouths of his own citizens in order to pay Soviet Russia for the weapons of war Mao Zedong's bottomless ambitions and careerism lusted for, both death counts in the tens of millions possibly combined into over 100 million, you might build a case for communism surpassing Nazism in the cataclysmic corners of genocide.
Well, yeah, it is just a side of of human nature that, you know, and the Bible said years ago that we have that side. Let's move on to law and order. I understand that there was an incident with the Clinton administration, that your departure from Law and Order had to do with them. Right. Why don't you tell us a little bit about that?
Okay, Dick Wolf, the producer, comes to me, and he asks if I would join him and others in a meeting with the Attorney General, Janet Reno. I was, as you might imagine, rather shocked and inquired what I should be doing in a meeting with Janet Reno. I mean, was she going to give me tips on how to be a prosecuting attorney? Dick says if she gets her way, shows like Law and Order could go off the air. Jesus, I think that's what I said. Apparently, Dick Wolf denies that version of the story. But then again, he has to. He's a careerist.
So did Dick Wolf go ahead and cooperate with them?
Well, here's what happened. Off we all go to Washington, D.C., right? And to the back dining room of a hotel, the name of which I can't remember. There was Dick Wolf, plus the head of primetime programming for NBC, one or two other executives from that network, Janet Reno's secretary, then Janet Reno and myself. Janet Reno was a large woman with extraordinarily big but beautiful hands. I tried to concentrate on what I could like about her, but I certainly was, she wasn't helping me or anyone else in that increasingly small and disturbing the breathless room. In the end, what she most reminded me of was Nurse Ratched in One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
Yeah, not a lovable character at all.
Though not as beautiful as Louise Fletcher, Janet Reno had a soul-rattling, cold, and eventually hiss-filled serpentine delivery.
Wow.
At the high point of her very dramatic appearance, she says, if you think I'm strident, Mr. Wolf, and that is how Dick Wolf had described Janet Reno's threats to control violence on television, he could call them strident, the Attorney General finished her sentence with this. From now on, Mr. Wolf, she hissed, I will talk no louder than this. All said in a completely flesh-curdling whisper.
Well, that sounds chilling.
You got it. I wish Janet Reno had been an actress instead of a lawyer and attorney general of the United States.
Yeah, well, some would say they're the same thing, but...
I wish all the careerists in America had been almost anything other than lawyers. Except, however, one man I became recently aware of, Larry Klayman. A lawyer who's defending American citizens in two class action lawsuits against the Obama regime. My Lord Christ, despite his usually contemptuous feelings for lawyers, described as Trinity, Holy Spirit, the Holy Ghost, that transmits truth from the Father and the Son, Christ described the Holy Spirit as his advocate, another much more respectful name for a lawyer.
Absolutely.
Ordinarily, my lawyer said that lawyers, quote, heap on other people pains which they, the lawyers themselves, could not endure.
That's a very interesting description. So then how did the Law and Order thing finally end? It sounds like you and Dick Wolf had a difference of opinion as to how to proceed and how to deal with the Clinton administration.
Oh, my God. Now we're getting to the tough part. I got to move ahead in my notes.
Sure.
So I get this right. I can tell you what happened in lieu.
Absolutely. Take your time. We want to make sure we get this straight.
And I don't want to wing it because I've written this all too well.
Absolutely. We want you to do it the way you're comfortable doing it.
Yeah. a belligerent. A belligerent threat equals the audacity of the Obama administration, because there's a relationship between Janarina's behavior and Obama's Justice Department. And Robert Mueller's sudden lack of information as head of the FBI about the IRS's indisputably unconstitutional attacks upon conservative nonprofit organizations.
Yeah. It's
not
harrowing.
To mention the Obama administration's refusal to answer questions about Benghazi.
And their convenient memory lapse.
Thank you.
The amnesia that they suddenly get on the spot. They don't know anything.
Now, Attorney General Janarino, as if she were the sole lawyer at the table of a deposition that she would be completely in charge of, allowed each of us to speak a few polite words of objection to her campaign against violence in television drama. Even the dramas like Murder, She Wrote, that only speak about violence but don't show it. She says they are a danger to the children of America. Well, ironically, there was hardly a terrifyingly more violent bit of television on the 6 o'clock news when the whole family can see it. Kids of any age, nothing more violent than the news reports of what the general, apparently that's the title Janarino prefers to be addressed as, general.
That's a good title.
There was not much more violence on TV than the TV newscasts about what Janarino had provoked in Waco, Texas.
That's what I thought you were going to say. Yeah, that Waco thing was a debacle.
The deaths of 54 American adults and 28 American children by fire and smoke inhalation. A fire provoked by General Janarino's order to attack the Korsh compound. That's over 80 very American martyrs as a result of one woman's decision and President Clinton's permission to storm a religious sect, one which the Texas authorities had previously found no probable cause for arrest, because every one of their firearms had been legally purchased. Now, if the nightmare of Waco, Texas were entirely the fault of the American citizens and had nothing to do with either Janarino or President William Clinton, I mean, really, is that true? No. Think about it, please. Now, here's what really shocking. Not since Janarino has America found herself with an attorney general quite so out of touch with American foundations and quintessentially American realities as is Attorney General Eric Holder.
He is a nightmare.
Well, I tell you this, and this is a certainty. If Janarino was not forced to quit, Eric Holder will never, ever, ever leave office.
If they force him to quit, he'd start talking about the fact that probably he's getting most of his cues from Obama.
He won't, because Janarino got away with it during the heyday of the Clinton years. They are not, the liberal press, going to do other than defend Attorney General Eric Holder in the same way they defended Janarino. It ain't going to happen. So we're stuck with Eric Holder,
right.
And as a result of that, we're stuck with every other program and plan that the Obama nation has in store for us.
Would you say that this incident with the Clinton administration and how they tried to interfere with law and order kindled your concern for where America is headed as a nation?
Oh, that's an understatement, kindled. I knew instantly what was going to happen. I went to New York and I testified before the news representatives of the basically liberal press what had happened in And guess what? The head of the ACLU, Ira Glasser, a friend of mine till I left, he came to testify that there was something smelly about what Reno was doing to television. That was the extent of his indictment, smelly. But then he tells me after he testifies, he tells me, Michael, you're going to be cut from the pack. Do you realize that? You're going to be ostracized.
And is that because you were one of the few that wanted to stand up to this?
Well, that was that era's Edward Snowden. Give me a break. And the outcry against Edward Snowden, I mean, I can't believe, but I now believe it, that Bolton, the former ambassador to the United Nations for about a year, speaks out about the terrible things that Edward Snowden did, about the most corrupt and, I would say, basically, not Marxist, communist administration of America. And Snowden speaks out knowing that everything in the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution is being broken. Speaks up, and Bolton, a conservative, attacks Snowden. Now this separates the men from the boys, the way Snowden's been treated. I went to Canada. He was smart enough to go to China before the news even came out.
Did you go to Canada because you feared some kind of retribution?
Yes. And
what,
I was right.
What do you believe they were going to try to do to you?
Oh, it doesn't matter. All they'd have to do, they would have to do a thing. Hollywood has left. I would never get another job. Do you understand?
Oh, yeah. No, I know what Hollywood's like.
You know, they don't have to hurt me. They just have to pull away my source of income.
Have you found peace? Have you found peace in Canada? Is it a nice place to live?
Oh, I can't tell you. Well, here's the irony of my life. And it's a wonderful irony. Until I had my heart failure years ago, which forced me to quit drinking and smoking, and I was killing myself with booze and alcohol. I never understood happiness on the earth till now. I've never been happier, never more content. I'm 24 hours a day with my music, and then writing, which I've been doing for over 12 years regularly, every day, writing articles about what's happened to America. I'm in a bleacher seat up here in Canada, looking down on a ball field that's filled with hell. United States of America.
Well,
you know, closer and closer to a civil war every passing month.
I think you're right about that. Well, I'm glad that you're experiencing some peace and happiness. You certainly deserve it. Speaking of your writing, you recently wrote a brilliant piece for Washington Times Communities. It was called, and I ask all our listeners, you should go online and read this. It's called Mutually Shared Sanctuaries Imprisoned in the White House. And in this article, you said, and I'm quoting you, Obama must confess and seek forgiveness for his allegiance to everything that would obliterate the original meanings of the Declaration of Independence and its reason for being the United States of America. There is no inalienable right to life under Obamacare's wholesale abortion. A gestating infant's safety under the words, all men are created equal. There is no protection for them under Obamacare. They now exist in an Obama nation of legalized murder where we live under a new golden rule, do unto gestating infants what you would not want done to your own gestating infancy. Those are not only chilling words, but they're brilliant words, the way you pointed out the irony. Would you care to elaborate on that?
Only one further comment. The heart of civilization, I mean worldwide civilization throughout the entire history of mankind, has been the golden rule. And you don't even have to attach where it came from, which is Judeo-Christianity.
Oh, sure.
A three-year-old would understand the golden
rule. Yes, anybody with a conscience knows the golden rule. Absolutely.
Yeah, kid, just don't do to somebody else what you wouldn't want done unto yourself.
It's very gone. Simple.
With
and yet
Roe v. Wade, it's gone.
That's right.
Now, when you destroy the golden rule, you're on another playing field. You're in communism. because there is no golden rule in communism. Yeah. Not at all. So you're living under worldwide communism now, and they're trying to veil it as progressive. It's progressive New World Order, which is the sickest.
Isn't it interesting?
Repeat, the sickest repetition of Hitler's desire to rule the entire world. Any program that wants to rule the entire human race and fit it into a neat little box is a tyrant, and there's going to be nothing but pain and hell and the unspeakable ahead of us.
Boy, you said it, and it's amazing how they find these nice sounding words like progressive that cover up what the true meaning is.
You know what my job as Eric Dorf was?
Oh, well, he was involved with propaganda.
Writing euphemisms.
Yeah.
That was my job as a lawyer, to come up with words that would lie about concentration camps.
Well, George Orwell predicted that years ago in 1984 that we would change the words we use to nullify the true meanings of them.
Yep.
Well, some conservatives give President Obama the benefit of the doubt. I'm not one of them, but some conservatives give him the benefit of the doubt by saying that, well, they think he does love his country, but he merely has a different philosophy about what is best for America.
Bob, they're in on the scam. They're in on the scam.
I agree.
It's a bipartisan scam. Do you understand?
Yeah, I think he knows exactly what he's doing.
George Bush Sr.
Yeah.
When George Bush Sr. in one term announces the New World Order, look it up. It's right there on YouTube. New World Order run by the United Nations. That is when the Clintons and the Bushes, who played volleyball with the Oval Office, traded it back and forth, you know, as if it were a ping-pong ball. When they started that game expecting that it would go Bush, Clinton, Bush, Clinton, and that Hillary would be the next president, guess what happens? By then, the Communist Party of the world, which now runs the world, knew it's time to step into the middle of the Democrat Party, take over the next nomination, and push the hard line. And the hard line would be delivered, ultimately, by Barack Hussein Obama. There would be no Obama without Bush, Clinton, Bush. Wouldn't happen.
Yeah, that's so interesting.
It's a bipartisan disease.
Yeah.
It is so disgusting.
Well, I certainly gave Bush a mixed review. He seemed beholden to Saudi Arabia. He was also putting pressure on Israel to make deals with the Palestinians, even though that contradicted his own doctrine about America never making deals with terrorists or countries harboring terrorists. Sounds like you've got a lot of problems with both Bush Sr. and Bush Jr.
Well, Bush Jr. became an operative for the United Nations plan, in which he became, and all the entire American military, became a police arm of the United Nations. And they called on Bush to bring his police corps, and because his father didn't kill Hussein, they said, will his son go after and kill Hussein? Kill him any way he can, whether it's by trial or shoot him, one or the other, get rid of him. And these were orders from the Arabs. And so America got itself embroiled in a situation and in a commodity which the American people never needed to get themselves involved in, because America has more than enough oil to deliver to the entire world. But now both the Republicans and the Democrats have tried to put a cap on top of American and North American Canadian oil, and they won't let it out, because that makes America what it always was intended to be by God: independent, strong, isolated. Eisenhower was right. Just pull in your horns, mind your own business, America, and let the rest of the world grow up to America. Grow up, world. Well, the communists are not only not grown up, they are psychotic. They are homicidal maniacs.
I would certainly like to see us sever our ties with the United Nations. That is such a evil, flea-bitten organization. They should close down that building in New York City and turn it into a public bathroom.
Listen, I mean, two presidents, Republicans, told you that the UN is the answer. America is becoming a doormat. Let me go further and describe
sure.
why. The first 4 years of Obama, His objective, which he accomplished, was destroy the American economy. That's his job, destroy it.
Yeah, absolutely. He acts like he's trying to save it, but he wants to collapse it and turn us into a socialist government.
It in 4 years. He not only destroyed it with tripling Bush's already humongous debt, tripling it, he made the debt permanent with Obamacare. That makes the American debt permanent.
Our country can never be the same again after that.
To the communist Chinese. Communism owns all the money, and America's on its knees now to all of communism. They got to go and ask and borrow from their mortal enemy. The mortal enemy of the meaning of America is communism.
That's right. We can't stand up to China because China holds all our purse strings now.
There you go. And the debt will continue because Obamacare is there to build debt. It's not to save a single life because these people don't want to save lives. They think there's too many people on the earth in the first place. Unless you understand the overall long-term program the communists have planned, but they're now they're progressives. You listen to, as an example, the brother of Richard Attenborough, David Attenborough, he's public come up with how many, just too many people, and the human race is a plague. This is a quote. The human race is a plague on earth. I beg your pardon. We are the salvation. And we are the promise. We are the promised people. We are God's children. And we are special in his eyes. And we are here not to go and kill each other. We are on earth. And our infinite vocation is to go out and explore the endless, infinite universe to people other planets that require things beyond trillions of human beings. There are not enough human beings to even begin where God wants us to go. There are not enough human beings. And we're being told we've got to just pull in our horns and kill a few thousand. And that's why there's going to be a World War III put together, devised by a renewal of the combat Cold War. They've already used the headline. There's a Cold War between Putin and Obama over Syria. Well, that's a big scam. That's been put up there so that both Putin and Obama, which are the good cop, bad cop of communism, Putin is actually the good cop now. And Obama's the bad cop, and they're dragging the American military because the next 4 years, the only job Obama has is to cripple the American military. They've crippled the American economy. Now they want to put the American military back into Vietnam. They want another Vietnam, and it'll be Syria, because not even the so-called allies of America want anything but the death of America and the death of Americans. So we're the setup. Now here's how obvious it is. Bill Clinton himself is beginning to say, gee, I don't think it's a good idea to go to Syria. Gee. And here's a man trapped in his careerism when he sold out to Moscow as a young man, as a scholar. He was a Rhodes Scholar.
Rhodes Scholar, yes.
Moscow, and he hooked up big time.
Do you think...
Now he's starting to see where it's all leading.
Yeah. Now, do you think, Mr. Moriarty, that the... As the far left keeps moving so far leftward, that those of us who might call ourselves centrists or say that we're in the middle, we appear more far right by comparison because the left keeps moving more and more left. So obviously, by relationship to them, we look more and more to the right.
Here's my analysis of the whole nightmare. Roe v. Wade. It began with a Republican president named Nixon and his Supreme Court. And the real villain of American history is the American Supreme Court. This is suicidal what the court's done. Jefferson warned us about the court, and I'm sure Lincoln would be pulling his hair out the same way he was when the Supreme Court made the Confederate slavery legal with a Dred Scott decision, the Confederacy was legalized by the American Supreme Court. Within 3 years, there was civil war.
Yeah, people should remember that when they talk about the Supreme Court and their wise ability to interpret the Constitution.
Oh,
I always say Dred Scott decision.
It's the evil. It's the chink. It's the Achilles heel. It's the suicidal corner of the American justice system. Now we have the Roe v. Wade decision legalizing murder, legalizing infanticide. And that ended the Golden Rule, which ends civilization. It ended the Declaration of Independence. All men are not created equal, and they do not have, upon creation, the inalienable right to life. They don't have it.
Yeah, Roe v. Wade and Dred Scott were very similar in that they were both deeming human beings as property.
Totally. Completely. And who did it? Our own Supreme Court. So as Lincoln predicted, America will not die by a foreign power. If it dies, it will be by suicide. Roe v. Wade is suicide.
I agree.
The communists love it. They just love it.
Well, the communists would call us useful idiots right now.
Thank you. Thank you very much. That is the phrase. Now, listeners, please do me a favor if you're still listening, despite my rants. If you're listening, please bump up YouTube and the name Yuri Bezmenov, a great man who was a former member of the KGB. He informed us and informs us everything about the KGB, and everything about Soviet communism. And you had better go and listen to him, because unless you want to be awake, you will be the very useful idiot that the Soviets said you are, and that the neo-Soviets, including Vladimir Putin, consider all Americans who are not in the higher echelon of communism.
Well, you said it. Mr. Moriarty, do you have any hope for the future of America, or do you think we're on a road without any turns right now?
I'll always have hope, because God's not going to let America die. Communists are atheists. They don't believe in God, and I don't for one second think that Barack Obama believes in anything but Barack Obama and communism.
Yeah, I always say Obama's not an atheist. Every time he looks in the mirror, he takes a bow, because that's the deity that he worships.
You look at in God, yeah, you got it. Now, the same way Stalin felt the same way, and Mao felt the same way. His big hero was Mao Zedong. You know, that's all over. That was in the first year it came out that how important Mao Zedong was to Barack Obama. I mean, there was Mao, if you can believe this, talk about sacrilege, on a Christmas bulb on the White House Christmas tree is the face of Mao Zedong. And next year it'll be Barack Obama.
Yeah. It's harrowing. Now, I think that our universities are, at least to some degree, for want of a better word, producing these useful idiots. Do our universities still teach people how to think, or are they instead teaching students what to think?
Yeah, well, they don't. But the issue in the end, the issue is you've either God exists or he doesn't. You believe God does exist or you don't. And if there is Bill Maher on television and the late Christopher Hitchin among the literati to inform us all that indeed there is no such thing as God, that indeed God is an illusion and a delusion. As long as that place, that position, POV of atheism is popular, America's headed toward hell. However, let me explain a couple of miracle men. Dr. Ben Carson.
Oh, I love Dr. Carson. Dr. Carson's wonderful.
Two extraordinary, true conservatives, Ben Carson and Alan West. As long as there are Americans like Alan West and Ben Carson, there's hope for America.
They are fine men, and they are brave men. Absolutely. What advice would you offer parents today that are thinking of sending their kids to an American university?
Buy your child a Bible.
I love it. Boy, and save how many grand? Boy, that's a
Buy your child a Bible.
What advice would you offer to a...
He takes that Bible to college.
Okay.
And that he carries it publicly. And that the Bible alone will provoke his fellow atheistic students to attack him. And he will start to see how endemic and how deep the problem is he faces. If he doesn't want the Bible, he doesn't believe in God. He doesn't believe in Judeo-Christianity. The 5,000-year-old oldest cultural monument that exists, the oldest on this earth. Islam is 1,600 years old, and Judeo-Christianity is 5,000. So I really don't think it's going down.
I don't think it is either. We're down, believe it or not, the time went by so quickly. We've only got a few minutes left. I'm going to jump to my last question here. Some say that those who today call themselves liberals are not true liberals, that a real liberal believes in liberation, not the government running every avenue of our lives. And many of today's conservatives describe themselves as being truly liberal at heart. And yet that very title conservative makes other people want to run. Can you think of a more accurate title that we can use today?
After 72 years on Earth and experiencing the hypocrisies of every major organization in the world, including the Catholic Church, what do you do? There's only one possible way for you as an American and a believer in individual freedom and responsibility. The only name that's important in identifying you is your name. All I am is Michael Moriarty. I'm not a Catholic. I'm not a Jew. I'm not a Maoist. I'm not a communist. I'm not a this. I'm not a that. I belong to no political party. I am Michael Moriarty. Just watch me and figure out who I am. That's all I have to say is I am Michael Moriarty.
That is very well put. You should just be who we are. When there's a title in front of our name, then people think they know what we believe before we've even opened our mouths, and then we never get a chance to speak for ourselves.
Unto thine own self be true, and thou cannot be false to anyone.
Okay, just a short amount of time. We'll have to have you on back to elaborate, but I want to go back to what you said about careerism. I know you believe that careerism is kind of the Achilles heel of America right now. Can you elaborate on that just a little bit more?
It was the heart of why Holocaust was made. The worst careerist was Eric Dorff. There was the example of how far your careerism could take you. And the blindness, it's about blind ambition you don't see. Now, let's talk about careerists in Hollywood, which is all far left. In supportive of Obama, let's talk about the mainstream press, the so-called liberal press. They're blind ambition. They want their jobs. They want to hold on to their jobs, and they want to move up in their ratings. And in some cases, even on Fox News, sometimes the horns are pulled in to protect your career because you don't want to offend too many people, so you have to, lighten up the message. And so careerism and basing your worth on how many people are in your audience can become a very dangerous pastime.
Okay, well, I wish we had more time. Please, would you do us the honor of coming on our show again? It was just wonderful speaking to you. And what you called rants, I call it prophetic. People need to hear your rants.
Well, thank you very much, and God bless you for having me on.
Absolutely. Okay, we will see you next week, everybody. This is Bob Siegel and Michael Moriarty today, just making the obvious obvious.
Bob Siegel Show on KCBQ is sponsored by Bob Siegel.